Basketball, a game of giants. And there's number 99, George Mikan, one of the greatest.
Perhaps the most complete player the game has ever seen. The Lakers captain, Elgin Baylor.
2 seconds, 1 second. West throws it up.
Jerry West made it from the other side of the mid-court stripe.
Ford sends it to Kareem. Sky hook up and good. Lakers win.
Magic down the middle, just what I thought. A hook shot at 12. Good!
Shaquille fade away. Yes!
Giants for the win. James puts up the three. Oh, it's good!
Doncic on the drive. Step back. Puts it up. Puts it in! With 0.5 of a second remaining!
What's up, Laker fans? You're listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. I'm Pete, joined by Darius and D. Mercifully, this is the last time that you and I are going to talk about Jonathan Kuminga for a while, because yesterday he signed a 2-year, $12 or $13 million deal, depending on who you're asking, with the Minnesota Timberwolves. Now, they will need to cut a little bit of salary to make that work, I think $2.1 million. But he chooses them over the Lakers on their taxpayer MLD. Reported that the Lakers offered a 3-year, $36-ish million deal. D, in a little bit, we're going to talk about a very important bit of context that somebody pointed out to us today that had us going like, oh, of course, how did we and pretty much everybody else miss this on the Kuminga contract? But it's over. I'm not crying in my beer over missing out on Jonathan Kuminga, but it certainly leaves some questions in terms of where the Lakers go from here and what their starting forward spot looks like. We did a pod about 3 weeks ago on what if this is the team. I think more than ever, it's looking like that could be the case. But how you feeling after the Kuminga saga finally comes to an end?
Mixed feelings, I think. Relief, for sure, that we will no longer have to dedicate real estate on the podcast to Jonathan Kuminga. Some disappointment as well, based off of my previous understanding and context of what I thought a contract could look like. I thought that the Lakers were well positioned to offer him the most money and to make it fruitful enough for Kuminga and his camp to ultimately say, no, a 3-year deal with the Lakers for X amount of dollars is going to be better than a 1 or 2 year deal with the Timberwolves. Yesterday, though, Pete, we thought Minnesota was only going to be able to offer the minimum. And we were looking at this from the perspective of how much gymnastics are you actually going to do in order to get Jonathan Kuminga on your roster. You had astutely pointed out a few pods ago that Minnesota was only about $4 million under the second apron, and that using the tax level MLE, which is 6, I think, would hard cap them at the second apron. And signing Kuminga would only push them to 13 players. So fitting 2 players into the $4 million range, how is that going to work exactly? So we were like, oh, Minnesota's going to have to give him the minimum. If he'll go play for Minnesota for the minimum, might he play for the Lakers for the minimum, which was some language that was floating out there based off of a recent Jake Fisher report. Turns out, Pete, that Minnesota's going to do some stuff. They're likely going to have to either stretch and waive Josh Green or make a cost-cutting trade of some sort. They're going to have to do something in order to give Jonathan Kuminga the $6 million that he's reportedly going to receive. So from that perspective, I felt like Minnesota did all their due diligence and they did everything within reason to get Jonathan Kuminga on board. And so good for them. They landed him. What's next for the Lakers? The Lakers are either going to do something in-house or they'll continue to try to work and find a trade solution. But in the end, Pete, as you said at the top, I'm not heartbroken over this by any means. I think the Lakers will ultimately be fine. I would have liked to have had Kuminga, and I was not in my head planning for a Kuminga team, but I was just like pretty far down the road in my head of like forecasting what it might look like to have him. And now they don't. And so we'll have more conversations later and maybe revisit the conversations about Jared Vanderbilt versus Jake LaRavia versus Adu Thero versus Zaire Williams or Mamu or however it goes. To me, I'm almost a little bit more heartbroken over the idea that we spent so many hours on this talking about him in the first place.
Yeah, merciful end to this. I'm so glad it's over. And one of the things that stood out as we got the reporting after he had agreed to terms with the Wolves was the reporting that the Lakers offered him a 3-year, $36 million contract. And I'm looking at that going like, interesting. They didn't budge on the numbers or the money or anything like that. And that was my perception of it last night. But as I led with at the top, somebody pointed out that there's actually totally different reasons for that, is that the Lakers were capped at offering that because the Lu Dort trade, right? Once Atlanta traded for Lu Dort, and I can't believe nobody caught this, but that was on July 19th, that hard capped Atlanta at the first apron. And the way that the mechanics for a sign and trade work, it's a sign and trade. So the signing has to happen first. So they couldn't sign Kuminga to a contract that exceeded the first apron for them. And they were like 11.55 million under the first apron. And so any contract that the Lakers offered at that point, that was the max that they could offer in the first year. And so even with max raises and all that, comes out to 36.4 million over 3 years. And so that totally changes my perspective on just the financial offer, that I wasn't super thrilled about going into the high teens about Kuminga anyway. But it turns out for the last month and a half, there was a window at the beginning of free agency. But from the Kuminga perspective, they were like, oh, Cleveland likes us. And they had to wait for the Peyton Watson thing to resolve, because if he didn't go to Cleveland, maybe Kuminga would have been an option over there. But all of that's to say, for the last 6 weeks or so, Lakers couldn't offer him more than this.
The reporting out there that the conversations had stalled with Atlanta, I would imagine it wasn't too long after that Dort transaction happened when ultimately the Lakers became way more limited. And one of the reasons why things might stall with Atlanta, Pete, is that they are not incentivized at all to do any of the legwork that they would have needed to do to open up more space under the first apron to allow the Lakers to then go up in their contract negotiations with Kuminga to be able to pay him more. So if Atlanta wanted to then go and say, okay, Kuminga wants a contract that is for MLE money, basically, right? And the Lakers are totally willing to pay him $15 million next season. That extra, I think you said they were 11.5 under the first apron. That extra $3.5 million, that's got to come out of Atlanta's roster.
And they got to do that first, right? They have to make that move first to free up the space. And then, but how is Atlanta incentivized to do that?
They're not at all, particularly if they're going to have to, what, go and trade someone into somebody's cap space or trade someone into someone's exception just to free up money so that they could help facilitate a sign-in trade to the Lakers. It's like, I was born at night, but not last night. If you're Atlanta, you're like, oh, okay, guys, we're all for having a working relationship with agents and with other teams and keeping up the good relations and making sure that, but I'm not going to go out of my way in order to do this. If you want to trade me Jaden Hardy, mm-hmm. or if you want to do a three-team deal where Hardy goes to a third team and you incentivize them to take on Hardy, we're more than happy to then trade you Jonathan Kuminga using the rules of the CBA that say, okay, you could absorb back up to X amount of dollars by trading a $6 million contract in Hardy. And with that, we can go up to $11.5 million and stay under the first apron, and that's that. The other thing I would say too, Pete, is that the Hawks, I would imagine they would also like to not go all the way up to the first apron just to do this. Teams often like to have a little bit of wiggle room under the first apron just in case what ends up happening to the Mavs a couple years ago, where, remember, they were hard capped at the first apron and then all of their players got hurt. And then they were ultimately playing games where they had exhausted all their two-way guys and they were like, how are we going to even, how are we even going to field a roster this game? And what's that going to look like? And so teams are going to want to have some cushion under the apron if they're hard capped to say, okay, we can give a guy a couple of 10-day contracts in order to bolster our roster. And if you're too close to the apron, you can't even do that because we're like 15,000 under the first apron. Guess what? You don't have a 10-day contract worth of money to pay. So let's go to break here, Pete. And when we come back, we'll keep it going. So when you shared this information with me, Pete, it did just reframe my entire view on everything. It wasn't that the Lakers only valued Kuminga at a certain amount of money. Nope. It wasn't even to me that the Lakers weren't willing to potentially expand the trade and maybe give up more assets in order to trade more salary out. It was the Hawks are limited here, and we have no way to incentivize the Hawks to do more. And they've got their own roster stuff to deal with. They're not going to go out of their way to help us. And ultimately, that's that. And Kuminga essentially chose between $11 million in a three-year format for the Lakers versus a $6 million deal where he can go back into free agency next season. Mm-hmm. If that's the only difference, Pete, like, I understand
the
choice. Yeah, like, I get it.
And even from the Lakers' perspective, how far are we willing to go for Kuminga? We had a discussion about the idea of Mr. Right versus Mr. Right Now. To me, he was the last starting caliber talent on the market. And that's why I wanted him. Lakers need a starting forward. And yeah, if you get him at a reasonable salary, that's totally good use of resources. But if you start getting into, okay, we need to incentivize Atlanta to make a first trade in the first place to help us out, then we need to pay him a higher number, then send out whatever draft compensation that we need to send out for that or for somebody else to take on, like Jaden Hardy and Dalton or something like that, right? Or they could be involved in that first trade. You start getting to the point of, is this good asset management in the first place? And that's where I want to go from here. Is I'd love to put the Kuminga discussion to the side and be like, okay, this is the team the Lakers have, and what should they do now? And the more I've thought on this, the more I'm of the position, I'm not super interested in the Lakers making moves for more backups. I actually like our backups. I think we've got a good bench. I think we've got good depth even in that 10 to 15 range. And that good bench even doesn't include a couple of young guys in Carr and Thero that I think could very well make it into that mix as well. I'm of the position right now, D, where I want either starting caliber talent or to roll with the guys that we have. I don't think that there's much value in trading for a backup. And so I'm just curious your thoughts on that idea you put forward earlier of internal development versus pursuing something on the outside. And what caliber of player should they be trading for in the first place?
The threshold, you have the threshold and the bar to clear. Like, I'm totally in sync and in line with you on that, Pete, is that remember at the very start of the offseason, and then seeing who the Lakers signed, it was very clear that they had a hole at the forward position, someone who can slot next to Luka. We also talked about that player having a certain amount of defensive versatility where if they needed to guard small forwards, they could. And if they needed to guard power forwards, they could. That was another sort of feather in the Kuminga cap of, okay, you can do both of these things. But a couple of the other names that we highlighted were Cameron Johnson, and we highlighted TJ Washington as two other guys that were on other teams that the Lakers would have to trade for. And to me, that's where the line is for me. It's like, those are good players. They make way more money than what Kuminga's going to make and what the Lakers were willing, or able is the better word, were able to offer Kuminga. But I think that they're appropriately paid for being like third or fourth starters on their specific teams that are going to serve an important role as, hey, you're a key guy for us. And that's a level of guy that I'm looking for the Lakers to get. The Mr. Right Now idea, like, so Cameron Johnson, the Nuggets aren't going to trade him, but I want to use him as an example here. He's on an expiring deal, but I would be totally willing to pay him beyond this season. And if the Lakers would have been able to trade for him, I would have instantly been talking with you about, hey, what's an appropriate extension number for Cameron Johnson, assuming he looks the way that we expect Cameron Johnson to look. And I would have been like, okay, this is the Lakers starting power forward for the next 3 to 4 years in the same way that they're projecting contracts for Mamu and Quentin Grimes as and Walker Kessler as being like, no, you guys are role players that we envision playing on the team. More and more, I'm looking for not only a guy who is a starting level guy, but a guy who they can keep beyond this upcoming season.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think they're trying to move past is that idea of stopgap solutions that were that bridge to the 2026 offseason. And I think that they've gotten several guys that fit that mold, just they're lacking that forward at this point. But in looking around the league, the pickings are kind of slim in terms of teams that I think would be looking to trade a starting caliber forward at some point. In going around the league, the main guy who stood out to me, I was like, I'm going to be rooting against Indiana this year. because Aaron Nesmith is probably my number one guy on a team that I think would have some incentive to make a deal, in that he makes $11 million this year, but he signed an extension that boosts that up to 19 next year and 20 the year after that. And Indiana is, I think, they have the fourth most amount of money projected for the 27-28 season. So if they have another bad season, which I don't expect them to have with Halliburton coming back, but if they're sort of a middling team, I could see them being incentivized to move either him or Obi Toppin. But in that whole idea of whoever is the forward next to Luka has to be able to defend on the perimeter, Toppin's more of a second big type of guy rather than somebody that you go stick out on the perimeter. But looking around the league, it was like Nesmith. Does Washington want to extend Koulibaly? It's pretty slim pickings in terms of guys who actually defend the perimeter. So I'm curious what direction they go, but if there's any PJ Washington, anything to any of those rumors, there had been reports earlier that Lakers were kind of meh on him and adding him. Even then, I was like, yeah, absolutely do that. But in looking around the league, there's just not a lot of teams that have a starting caliber player that can defend the perimeter that I think would be willing to trade them in the first place. So a lot of this, to me, points toward internal development and giving young guys and backups, frankly, those type of chances and hoping that one of them hits, which I'm not thrilled about, but I think that might be the best route to take.
Yeah, and I remember earlier this offseason, Pete, you were saying, like, and this was within the context of a Kuminga discussion, you're like, look, he's the last dude out there that the Lakers can get without having to jump through a billion hoops or convince a team that they should trade one of their better players to the Lakers for cap relief and a couple of seconds or a first round pick swap that may not mean anything. And you were like, so if the Kuminga thing doesn't work and they don't get him, you're like, it's going to change my view of this offseason. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you've sort of reconciling that idea with what's the current condition of the marketplace and what the Lakers have. And am I reading that right? Or are you going to push back against my perception of that right now?
It does change my view on the overall, what's your grade for the offseason? We don't do grades and stuff like that very often, but they absolutely set up all their ducks in a row for this offseason to be the one where they made a bunch of moves, and they did. But I am not thrilled that we're in this position of not having a starting forward, while also looking at the circumstances and being like, I think one of the worst things they could do is to just keep lowering the bar of like, if you squint, this guy's a starter, let's trade assets for somebody that's just actually really another backup. We have decent backups. Let's roll with them if we can't get a starter, and then save those assets so that we can trade for them. So let's go to break here. I want to come back and get your response to that.
No, I agree. We talked about this some in yesterday's pod. Like, I still hold some Vando stock, and I'll be interested to see how Laravia plays next season. I thought that his decline offensively looked way more about confidence than it did about how good a player he can actually be on that side of the ball. I get that the game he had in Minnesota was like his high watermark, but the low watermarks of this season were also like well below what I would expect to him. I get it. You're not going to be a guy who can score 25 on any given night and just have it look effortless. You're also not a guy who should be taking two shots a night and going 0 for 2 and looking to play like a hot potato with the basketball.
That was the thing, man, is he wasn't even looking at the basket at certain point, which speaks to your point about confidence. But I can make upside arguments about Laravia. I can make it about Zaire Williams, guys like that. For me, Adu is actually the guy that I'd zero in on, and I'll give my argument in a moment, but I think that's a hope and a prayer type of
approach. We don't want a wish cast.
Yeah, it's a little wish casting.
Yeah, we don't want a wish cast. And so this is my point, is in going back to like the Pacers idea that you were talking about, Nesmith is exactly the sort of dude that you were talking about that I'm like, I would be excited about that. The other thing that I would say is, like, last night I said, what do you think of like Sadiq Bey? He was a guy that we had talked about before. And I think that he probably doesn't clear that bar for you as this, okay, you might be a higher level backup, but you're probably still a backup.
Sure.
And if you were a starter, you would be that stopgap starter. You wouldn't be a guy where it's just like, oh yeah, Sadiq Bey starting forward for the Lakers for the next 3 or 4 seasons.
Yes. And I actually like Bey. There are two parts to it that are arguments against him, in that I don't think he's a forward who guards people for a living. I think he's a decently well-rounded two-way player, but I think he's a little better on offense than he is on defense. And then I know that the Pelicans have several forwards or several guys at his position, but he makes 4% of the salary cap. Now, maybe they want to trade him for something at the deadline because they don't want to sign the next contract of his, which this is the last year of his, and so maybe that would happen. But I don't see it as particularly realistic for us to get him, but maybe.
One of the reasons why I wanted to talk about New Orleans in general, too, when I was texting you about it, was like they just signed Ben Mathurin. And this is a team that has Trey Murphy, and they already have Herb Jones, and they're adding Ben Mathurin to that. They've also got perimeter players, like they just drafted Jeremiah Fears, and they've got Murray as well. And then obviously their bigs in Zion and Derek Queen are also ball handling bigs. They're guys who are sort of hub players. And so where does a guy like Bay fit into that equation? And in some regards, even a guy like Herb Jones, while he complements all of those guys very well in terms of what his skill set is, a low usage defensive player, he's also a guy where there's a bunch of other dudes that are going to play minutes. And so how much is Herb Jones going to play without squeezing minutes of Trey Murphy and Ben Mathurin and, to a certain extent, maybe even Fears and Murray? It's just like there's only so many perimeter minutes to go around. And so the Pelicans were an interesting target to me, but honestly, you and I think, are lower than consensus on a guy like Herb Jones. I would absorb him tomorrow for the right sort of deal for sure.
My issue is that they're like, oh, we want multiple first round picks for Herb Jones. And I'm like, what? But with the assets that the Lakers have, of course I'd trade for Herb Jones with what we've got.
And so when you go around the league, Pete, I'm just like, okay, there's just not a lot of these guys out there, with no sort of inkling that one of these guys is going to shake free either from a lower cost perspective or even a guy like Jeremy Grant, who makes a ton of money but is in Memphis as a very bad team. It's not like there have been any whispers. It's, oh, yeah, I'm hearing that Memphis is working on a buyout with Jeremy Grant. I would totally sign Jeremy Grant for the minimum and treat him as a stopgap. There are levels to this. But in the bigger picture, Pete, it's just like, okay, if there's not an ideal solution out there, and Nesmith would be that guy for me, I don't know, man. I'm just going to look internally and be like, all right, let's do a blood sport competition between these guys and hopefully iron sharpens iron and give these younger guys a chance. I guess that's where I'm at. So talk to me about Adu.
Yeah. If I were to think of what is the ideal championship caliber roster, and who is the player that plays alongside Kessler and Luka in the front court? Again, looking at this from the defensive end of the floor, I know Luka plays guard on the offensive end, but that other forward spot, Luka is essentially a backline type of player. You don't want him guarding out in space any more than he has to. And so that necessitates that the other forward is able to guard the perimeter. But beyond that, I think that other forward, it would be really beneficial if that player was really athletic. That was part of the appeal of Kuminga as well. And Adu having that ability to defend forwards, he's sloppy at it, he's young, he needs reps and all that. But in terms of raw talent, I think we all see the talent that he has that is just at a totally different tier for me than Jake or Zaire Williams, who just doesn't weigh enough to guard those type of guys. I actually see Williams as in some ways a tall two or a three defensively, rather than a 3-4 type of guy, despite his taller, long wingspan and all of that. It's just that the weight that he's at, I think he's going to have a hard time defending those type of guys that have that advantage. But Adu's both got that strength and that athleticism and some defensive talent, where so much of what I don't like about Adu is that I find him to be a very immature player, not from a personality standpoint, just from a you do dumb young guy stuff. That one of the best cures for that is getting reps and getting minutes. And I want there to be just an organization-wide and a team-wide. If we can get this dude to the level that he's got the talent to reach, this helps on so many levels that I just want them to have just an extra degree of investment in him, because I think the payoff there is high enough.
I see that vision for sure. I'm glad you chose the word immaturity within the context of his game, because he seems like a level-headed enough kid. He actually seems competitive in certain ways where it's like, okay, like he wants to get it after it. And sometimes his eyes can be too big for his stomach in that ways. And I think that then creates that cycle of the immaturity coming out of his game, because every moment of an NBA basketball game to me is about understanding and choices. And the choices need to come from role understanding and doing the right thing over and over again. And it's the players who, when they come to that fork in the road, at whatever point in the possession that the fork in the road presents itself, if they choose the wrong fork consistently, that's how you end up on the bench. And that can look like a dumb player, when in reality, what it is a player who is making the wrong choice over and over again. Now, maybe that is because they're not a smart player.
Sure.
But I happen to think that there are more times where we don't credit players enough for just being like, no, that's what I want. So I'm going to go do that. And there's like an impulse where it's just like they don't have those internal reins that they put on themselves to guide themselves in the right direction, possession after possession. And it's like a discipline. And I think investing in a do in a way where you are presenting the discipline of his game as being the goal for him, not to limit him, but to channel him. In some ways, those are the same discussions I'm sure Warriors people were having about Jonathan Kuminga when he was coming up. It's just like, no, man, we see the talent. And he was a lottery pick. And so that's like a different level than what we're talking about with the do. But it's still like, where's the extra pass? All right, you see that guy cutting right there. Why are you not putting the ball onto him instead of going between your legs one or two extra times in order to shoot the pull-up midi, right? But for Kuminga, it was like, this is how I'm going to grow my game. You want me to be a lottery pick and fulfill my lottery talent, don't
you? That's right. And that's one of the differences, I think, between Adu and a guy like Kuminga is that I think Adu starts with that role player type of mentality and even spoke to that at Summer League where he was like, Coach Redick told me that this is my route to being able to get minutes, is to be able to defend. And as a second round pick, I think it's a totally different mentality.
Can I ask you a question? Because you said that it would be helpful if the player next to Luka was super athletic. And it's sort of what like drove you to Adu. But Adu's limitations offensively, while he can be a wonderful slasher, obviously he's got a bunch of like paint finishing and rim finishing ability. He can put the ball on the ground for one or two dribbles and just get to the basket. We saw that during Summer League. He's not a shooter and he will compromise spacing, honestly, in a lot of the same ways that Vando compromises spacing, because even if he's a better shooter than Vando, teams are going to treat him the way that they treat Vando. What say you about the opposite archetype of player? A player who is not an uber athlete, but is more of a floor spacer and a shooter. He's a good defensive player, but is not the lockdown chaos engine. He's more of a positional defender guy. A player who fits this archetype to me is like Royce O'Neal. He spaces the floor. He can play above the break or in the corner. He's not going to wow you with athletic play over and over again, but he will be in the right place. He's going to compete, and he's going to mostly do his job, even if he too will sometimes be overwhelmed by the superior athlete with superior size. But as a veteran with know-how, what do you make of that sort of dude as a counter to Luka and helping with the spacing element for the Lakers rather than the downhill above the rim element?
So I want to clarify that I'm talking long term. This is a multi-year investment in Adu. This is not an argument even to start him this year. I don't think that he should start, but I do think that with Kuminga going elsewhere, he should be in the rotation. And that's part of the investment, is to have him play through his mistakes and do all of that. But even Cameron Johnson fits the archetype of what you were talking about as being somebody who's competent on the defensive end, but not a great athlete, but can space the floor and really provide help in that respect. I think guys like Johnson and O'Neal can get you to a certain level of team. I don't think that collectively, though, they would have the requisite athleticism to really compete at the highest levels. That's where all of my goals are pointed toward, D, and that's part of the reason why I would rather be a little bit worse this year than give up assets or make a move for Mr. Right now, because I want them to be able to build a championship caliber team that I think they'll need a certain boost in terms of the amount of athleticism that they have. Now, if that's not a do, I totally get it. I just think it has to come from somewhere else. And I think that they've really improved in terms of speed from getting Sexton and Grimes and even a guy like Zaire. And I'm excited about Cam Carr as well. But with a do, he represents that sort of, if he hits, this is exactly the type of player that could fit in. And to the point about the lack of spacing, I do think that he needs to get to a certain baseline of three-point shooting that he's not at yet. But I do think that's something that over time that can be developed. Derek Jones Jr. being an example of one of these, just, oh my God, type of leapers that developed into a competent enough three-point shooter. But with respect to the Vando comp, where that falls a little flat to me is that Adu is such a freak athlete that there are a handful of guys in the league like Giannis and Zion that I think Adu isn't quite at that level of doing this, but I think he's one of the handful of guys that can, if you sag off of him, that just gives him a runway to drive to the basket. That I was really excited by the drive and kick game that he showed in the summer league. Totally different level of basketball, I get it. But just that, like, no, I'm going to eat up this space and you will have to collapse or I'm going to dunk on you. And then I can kick it out from there, that it can at least keep the wheel going. That I think he's got some exception to the rule level of that athleticism.
Yeah, I was actually listening to Zach Lowe talk about Russell Westbrook in the same exact way,
yeah.
in like his little tribute to retirement. And he was talking about Russ's playmaking evolving in a way where he became so good at it. But one of the reasons why he was so good at it is that he was so explosive and dynamic in terms of getting to the paint and beating his defender that so many players collapsed on him that it made his reads easier.
Yes.
Now, Russ developed into being able to make all kinds of passes, and we never really did talk about his retirement. But that idea of, no, I have compromised the defense in a way that my passing reads are way more elementary than the crazy stuff that you might have to do, that like Trae Young might have to do because of his size or whatever, where it's just like, yeah. Oh my God, like where'd that pass come from? Adu can be better at that just in terms of like, oh, I'm in the lane, I'm big, there's three guys around me, there's a wide open teammate that's out there. But I do want to see Adu get chances, just like I want to see the competition amongst these guys. And I do think that having a defensive mentality at this position is going to be important. I do believe that a certain baseline level of offensive utility is going to be important. And right now, the options on the roster are limited, but I'm like willing to see how those play out, even though I know where it's going to go. They still got the ammunition to try to go out there and make a lower level deal that could potentially get them the guy that we're talking about. And so my head is not in my hands by any means, Peach. Kuminga's a Timberwolf, and good for him. And I'm glad that we laid out everything the way that we did earlier in the pod.
Yeah. All right. We'll wrap up here. We'll be back tomorrow. But until then, been listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Baines has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front. Broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
And Magic got it. Magic fires. It's good. The Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game. Rebound of Lottie. 3 seconds left.
That
next to the winner. It's on the way.
Good! Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. Shaq with his eighth block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe. Hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal! Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Pretty pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move.
Two.
Score.
One.
Miss it.
Bryant. Unbelievable. It's over.
Shot clock now to five. Bryant. Yes.
With a little tap to Albert Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis. 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good! Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers! James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.